Captain Picard accuses the Ligonians of committing an unfriendly act. Riker thinks being called commander is quite formal. And Data has told Geordi 662 jokes to no avail. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Seventh Rule with Sirach Lofton and Denise Crosby. My name is Ryan T. Husk. Today we're doing a review of, Next Generation, Star Trek Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 3, Code of Honor, written by Catherine Powers and Michael Barron, directed by Russ Mayberry and Les Landau. More on that later. This was October 10th, 1987. And also very special thanks to Tim Baum, a.k.a. Grandpa One, for sponsoring this entire season. Thank you, Tim. We love you, man. And everybody just listening in, the reason we got a little sidetracked there is because Denise very expertly put her hands up in the Ligonian welcome move. How's everybody doing?
Doing good.
We're good. We're good. The rain has let up for a little break. And we're doing good.
And we get to talk about Code of Honor. What more could you ask?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it seems like the Ligonians invented the hands up, don't shoot greeting.
Oh,
oh.
Plus.
Wow, that's where that came from.
That's where it's from, yeah. Come on, not me.
They're all Trekkies.
And Picard's trying to like get in, he's like, hey, huh? Am I right? Dude's like, yeah, I guess.
Wow.
This was a doozy of an episode, that's for sure. There's a lot of going on in here.
Was there?
Kind of. Yes and no. Yes and no.
Yeah.
You know, I have scratched my head on this one for so long, and even while shooting it, I was scratching my head thinking, what are you getting at? You know, what is the point of this? Now, given the 24th century, we don't supposedly see color, you know, of skin at this point. We are beyond but a person tuning in 1987, it's so blatantly just, what are you doing? You know, what are you saying here? And what are you inferring? And it's so clumsy and awkward and so ultimately just offensive in so many ways, in a certain way, you know? And I just, you know, people have said they should remove Code of Honor from the series, from the availability in Next Gen, which of course I say absolutely not. That would be the quintessential example of, you know, cancel culture. This was what people were writing in 1987. This happened. We should look at that and try to decipher, try to unravel what is the, you know, underlying meaning of what are you trying to say here? You know, it sits so uncomfortably for me as a woman. What was inferred, that women are nothing but the land they own, that, you know, they're nice little things, but they really are useless and meaningless in every way, except for the property they own and the value they bring to this marriage. And, you know,
and also how in both scenarios, they are being used as pawns in this male game.
My God, the most misogynistic, uncomfortable, you know, is scenario that we've ever seen.
Yeah,
and I mean, what an insight into a female co-wrote this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But again,
that was a little puzzling.
It is very, on seeing it again, just now was really astounding. I mean, I felt it. Listen, I walked around thinking, there's no way this is going to air. I mean, it just pushes.
Oh, really?
While I was shooting, I don't remember
who it was, but there were some actors saying, I remember just a couple years ago that kind of, I don't remember who it was, but they said something to that effect of like, are we doing this? I guess we're going to go, you know, where there was like a little bit of trepidation while it was being shot. And I wish I'd remembered who'd said that.
I mean, the whole premise, and of course I was so central in this episode. So
again,
I was really cool. Well, it's funny. The first couple, you know, it feels like it's the Tasha Yar story. But it really felt like I was, you know, I was bearing the brunt of this episode. So I was particularly concerned where this was going and what this, you know, mm-hmm. so many stereotypes and so much, mm-hmm. you know, stuff that hadn't really been talked about yet, but that were, you know, a Black woman, you know, is being discarded so that her, you know, Black husband can take the white, prefers the white woman. I mean, even though that's not inherently what they're intending to say, it says that. And this has been an issue in our culture that wasn't really talked about at this point. And so, you know, it was really, it was, there was, it hit so many notes.
I believe that they were insensitive of a lot of things. One, dealing with race and the way that Black men are perceived, specifically categorized in this area of sexuality and extreme sexuality, you know, those kinds of perceptions have been, you know, predominant throughout history when talking about Black men. And I think they really played on that in this particular episode. And that's one of the first things that I found offensive, was the way he was kind of brooding over you in the beginning. Like, you know, like, yeah, I want this woman, in a kind of caveman type of mentality or attitude. And that was the first thing I felt. I was like, oh, wow, we're going there. You know, we're going to do the classic. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
This is what we're doing. Man. And you're like 7 minutes in. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Right. And also Tasha's, well, I was just going to say, you know, I was astounded, and I'd forgotten that, you know, even up toward to the very end, Tasha, when the wife makes her choice to leave him, and she says, "You want him?" You know, she, instead of going, "Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
look what he did to me. Look what he's done. He kidnapped me and made me, you know, ask me, demanded that I kill you." You know, of course not. I don't. She's like, "Well, I kind of do, but there'll be complications."
That was something I had missed previously. And I really, and this time I was baffled by that. I was like, wait a second, hang on a second. Yeah, like, I understand her not wanting to offend a new race, or, you know, you got to be diplomatic. But what they were insinuating was that Tasha was actually a little bit, you know, kind of into it or into him. And in the past, we've said, look, it's almost impossible to show two people believably falling in love or liking each other in an episode.
Right.
But it's even more impossible when you don't show any reason why they would. They gave us zero reason. Like, I remember I was thinking, you take away the kidnapping part and you give them a couple nice moments, you know, like, for example, if they say, oh, you better not walk on this rug, otherwise that's against the rules. And she stumbles onto the rug, and then maybe the leader sees it and he looks around, nobody's watching, and he just kind of helps her up and kind of says, we won't say anything. Like a little moment like that. And they could be like, oh, wow, he respects her, she respects him. You give him these kind of moments. But there were none of that. There was him kidnapping her. And then she's like, oh, well, he's kind of cute.
What? Wait a minute. That's so out of character of, you know, how they set her up and the whole Starfleet agenda and being a Starfleet officer and the prime directive and all of that stuff, that it was like, man, you guys are just throwing all of your logic, the premise, the foundation of this entire show out the window.
Mm-hmm. It was just, I think it was a poorly executed way to try to tell a story about the needs of the many versus the needs of the few, or one in this case, which would be your character. And they did a poor job of relaying that to me as the viewer, because they put no emphasis on your safety or well-being. That was an afterthought to the vaccine or to respecting somebody else's culture, or it became the last important thing, you know, safety, your well-being. I mean, they were talking about, when you were kidnapped, they were like, well, is she going to be raped or something? They were casually saying, well, I don't know, you know,
probably not.
Typically, typically,
let's be patient.
Give it 24 hours.
Let's respect their culture more than we get our goddamn security officer off the ship.
Give them 24 hours with her and let them figure it out. I'm like, what?
I know.
Like, what the hell? Who's cool with that?
Just every note is a head scratcher. In this, like you were saying, Ryan, before we started, you know, I was trying to find one redeemable, you know, moment. I like the shot that you put up, you know, in the background.
Right. This was one of the few things where I was like, oh, that's a nice shot. Let me put that in the notes so I have one nice thing to say.
One thing that we can, pretty. You know, go, okay, it's pretty. I like the silhouettes of the trees, you know.
I like the amount of work that the art team put on the marble floors and the red and the back. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, but I was like, okay, not everybody screwed up here. The art department did their job. They're like, hey, whatever. We still make things look good.
Right. Oh, and what about my stunt, the stunt double? God, it's so obviously bad and wrong and shot so badly at times. Mm. You know, it's so clearly not me. I mean, like full facial, not me. You know, it's one thing to be behind me, you know, and you got the wig and the suit and it looks, you know, the shape looks right. But if you're cutting to my face and it's so obviously not me.
Yeah, they've done that now twice, because in the pilot, when you were doing the fight scene in the trial, they had an aerial shot of you fighting, and I was like, "That's not her. Like, that's not even a. It's not even a good job of faking it. It was like a guy with brown hair and everything. I was like, dude, at least give him a blonde wig
with a cigarette.
You know? It's so. Oh my god, it's so.
I was like,
bad.
This guy's got a mustache. Make him shave. Yeah. What kind of stunt double?
And they trained. I mean, I was, you know, we were working out on the side with the stunt people. We had all that, you know, going on. They really didn't need a stunt double in
no,
this.
No, I thought you were very good at just making yourself look very physically capable in the keto scene, for example. I mean, you just your body stance and the way you were holding yourself and carrying yourself. I was like, she could do something. She could do some damage. You didn't look awkward. Like, you know, sometimes you watch a basketball movie and you could tell the guy's never played basketball in his life.
Totally.
Does not dribble properly. I feel
very called out right now, Srog.
We won't talk about that.
Thank you. But
this is, you know, I believe you as the security officer. I believe your physical prowess. I believe that you're capable, more than capable to get the job done, which is why all the more reason why it seems so awkward that they would put you in this position. And even furthermore, you know, they just played around with Tasha's sexuality. Remember, she has trauma.
Major.
That right? They, right? She has a literally a case file of trauma where all of these people know about her history. They know that she's survived gang rapes and grew up in a hard, in a harsh environment at a very young age and had to really overcome a lot of things. This is the exact kind of thing you don't want to put somebody in.
With it was that, like Stockholm syndrome scenario. All of a sudden.
I'm in the same scenario, sexualized.
Yeah, fighting for your life.
Desired, fighting for my life. You know, the guy wants me. He's going to keep me. He's going to take me. And these guys were like, let's be patient.
And meanwhile, you have an audience like with, you know, Picard and the crew like sitting there like, oh, very good. Let's see. Let's watch this. Let's be patient. Let it play out. And I'm thinking there's no regard for this woman's trauma, her history, the kind of mental anguish she's been through, the kind of anguish she's currently going through right in front of your face. I remember when Picard gets to the station, he's like, have they been treating you well? And I'm like, like, you know, I'm held against my will, even if you're giving me caviar and foot massages. Like, you know, I didn't sign up for this. It's not a vacation. This is like you holding me against my will. So, yeah, you could treat me well, but I didn't sign up for this treatment. And I just felt like it was a whole lot of things that they, you know, they also wanted to hit home the prime directive. And that was another kind of, you know, underlying message that was running through the storyline. So it was about the needs of the many. It was about the prime directive and kind of combining those two Starfleet rules to, you know, see how they would problem solve in a situation like this. I just thought it was tasteless in so many ways. But Ryan, what's the actor's name who did play, the main Lagonian, I think his character was
Lutan.
Jesse Lawrence Ferguson.
Exactly.
Was it Jesse Lawrence Ferguson?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I want to say he did a great job, though, given the fact that he was given these parameters. Obviously, he's not writing. Yeah, his voice, his performance.
He's got to do voiceover. I was thinking, like, if they ever need somebody to replace James Earl Jones, like, he's got that same kind of richness to his voice.
And I thought his performance was very good, even though I didn't like the fact that he was playing these stereotypes. I did like his performance, and it's not easy to carry a whole episode as a guest star
with a rough script.
With a rough script like that. Bring that kind of I thought he brought a lot to the character. He was interesting. I was looking at him. The screen loved him. His voice was obviously phenomenal. And I thought his performances opposite Picard were a very good match for Picard's power, or the strength that Picard kind of exudes. I thought it was well matched by Jesse Lawrence Ferguson's performance.
That's a good point. He does need to match up, you know, with energy wise. You know, rather than otherwise, he kind of feels like a shrinking violet type, and he had to play somebody that's perfectly fine going toe to toe with some of the big boys of the Federation. That's true.
Yeah, and there is an interesting dynamic there, a tone and of the whole Ligon planet is the culture is predicated on honor, you know, on respect. And that is a very interesting kind of notion to understand, you know, that their strength comes from the feeling of being respected and honored. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you you know, you've got this black king and this white captain, and you know, the dynamics that are being shared in that, and that Picard really needs to understand that his, you know, his place of understanding as a culture is not his place. So he must respect that. Mm-hmm. And that's just been a real, you know, historically a complicated issue, you know, in our society.
You know, I wish I had gone and sorry, Sirach, what were you going to say?
No, what I mean, you know, what you were saying, Denise, kind of reminds me of United States' interaction with other countries and how we try to frame their society in whatever lens of our own Western ideas and try to ridicule these people, whoever they are, for having a belief system or having traditions and culture that are outside of the quote unquote norms of Western civilization. So I do think that there is a good, you know,
there hang on, Sirach. FBI has just entered the chat. You were saying,
oh yeah.
I was so, saying, no. Oh boy, let's go to those other countries and tell them the best way to live.
I mean, it happens, and so I mean, you know, this is something we've done throughout the Middle East. I mean,
from the beginning of time, you know, and not only us, but you know. God, I was just in Mexico, and you know, you see what the Spaniards did, you know, to that country. They came in, and the first thing they wanted to do to the, you know, indigenous people is you know, Christianize them, you know, basically get them all signed up to their religion, and so that they could you know. They could get a place in heaven, and they could rise in their stature, and basically they could take their land, you know, and get them to obey. So it's my God, this is just.
Yeah, I think the problem I had was with the kidnapping. Period. I feel like if they had have altered the story slightly, and made this person more intelligent about the way they operated. I think, for example, let's just put it out there, if culturally or in their custom, they wanted to get you, right, onto their planet, there could have been a way to exchange and say, well, we'll offer you our captain or our security officer, and we'll do an exchange so that you guys can learn more about each other's culture. And it could have been very simply left at that. And then you get caught up in a situation that's weird or something, and you know that you're uncomfortable with.
And then certainly it's a lot easier for it's a lot easier for us to believe that Tasha might have feelings for this man if something like that happens, and they're sharing good moments together, and he's showing her about his culture, and they're exchanging ideas. Suddenly, it's an episode about two cultures, you know, people from two different cultures coming together, and like a little Romeo and Juliet kind of thing, you know. So much better that way.
So you know, why didn't you just embrace that story? You know, they're both, you've set it out where they're both feeling for each other. There's a there's an attraction that's you know, sort of underneath everything. Let's build out, you know, let's explore that. What is that? And then it becomes, you know, truly a dilemma for both of them. Does she stay? Does she go? Does he, you know, demand it? Does he let her go? You know, what a great, all with this vaccine being, you know, imminent and needed. And so what an interesting story that would have been.
By the way, somebody, speaking of the vaccine, somebody said that at the end of the episode, once they finally get the vaccine, and we know countless millions are dying from this, and they're like, all right, you know, go to that, whatever that planet was, warp 3.
Oh,
what? Warp 3? What's going on? They're like, yeah, we don't have that many vaccines. We got to let a few of them kind of, you know, see what happens.
Just cruise. So a million dies. Yeah. They've still got a couple million we'll save, you know?
Warp 3. Give me a break. Anyway, hey, we've got to jump to our break. I was also hoping to provide a little bit of backstory on this episode, which you may be shocked to find out does not make this episode any more understandable. We'll be right back on the seventh rule. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Seventh Rule with Sirach Lofton and Denise Crosby.
Hello, hello.
Here are the trivioids for this week. Boy, there are a lot of landmines to step on, but I think I navigated through them. Styrus 4 needs a rare vaccine. The Ligonians have a highly structured society. Achilles' fever is dreaded. Ligon wants to see a holodeck. Picard accuses the Ligonians of committing an unfriendly act. Ooh. Picard lets Wesley sit at ops on the bridge. Riker thinks Commander is quite formal. Geordi doesn't like the razor that Data adjusted to perfect efficiency. And Data has told Geordi 662 jokes to no avail. They did kind of have an obsession with Picard being like, well, this is an unfriendly act and you're being mean and I'm not sure if you're... They just kept saying like, he's like, well, we will be your friends. And like when he said, when the head Ligonian said Luton was like at the beginning, he says, oh, well, if you guys respect us and really kiss our butts and do everything right, then we will consider you friends and we will give you the vaccine to save millions. And Picard's like, oh, why are they clapping now? Why not just say, well, yeah, you should.
Great. That's why you're here. Yeah. That, I mean, it's a political negotiation. Yeah. Can you imagine? You know, like, yeah, we meet the new president, Lula of Brazil, comes to, you know, the White House, and you see Biden just, you know, everybody, Kamala Harris, you know, applauding everyone, you know, because we're here to exchange natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? And that was one of the things that bothered me watching this episode was I felt like Picard came across as weak to me. And, you know, usually we see the captain being proactive and making decisions that will, you know, whatever, you know, we're gonna get us into trouble, but it's going to try to solve the situation. So, you know, Picard, like, I think like Sisko in that situation might have said, okay, I need a team of you guys to go over here and go get the, you know, vaccine without their permission. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have you guys go and do this while I set up a meeting over here. So there's going to be multiple things happening. I felt like Picard was going along. So what shall I do next? And what about where do I stand? And where do I wait? And that's not the kind of actions that I see a captain taking. They're usually like proactive. This is the plan. This is what we're going to do. I need you to go over there. I didn't sense that. He was kind of following the carrot.
Absolutely right. He would even say to Tasha, are you sure you're up to this? You can do this? Really?
Instead of coming with a plan and saying,
you're not doing this. You're my security. You're chief of security. You're not doing this. I'm not letting you die. You think you're pretty sure you can take her. You're pretty sure you can win this fight, but that's not good enough. It's not pretty sure.
It's not worth the risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Great observation. Yes. I also, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week with the question of Troy being constantly, you know, at his side, and you know
that's not good.
This was like there was a shot when they walked away, they were in like lockstep.
Oh, I played that three times. Yes, it looked like a dance.
Yes.
I'm so glad you caught that.
I would be like, ew. Give me some space.
But they turned in complete I played it back three times because I was like, is this like a little dance? Was this rehearsed?
Absurd. It's just absurd.
It was absurd.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, it's not the worst thing in the show, but it's like, you know, come on, guys.
Well, I mean, there was a moment when Picard looks over at Riker for permission, like for permission. Riker's like, I'm not going to let him do it. I won't do it. And I'm like, who the hell's the captain here? Like, you're waiting for permission.
What about when Riker was about to go rough up a teenager when Picard says, oh, what do you, Wesley's in the turbo lift. Riker's like, don't worry, I'll handle this. And he starts storming. I'm like, whoa, what are you going to do? I think about, what are you going to pick him up and throw him out of an airlock? Teach him a lesson? What's going on?
Yeah,
here?
like the other guy, like in the, what was it? I think it was an encounter at Farpoint when Worf was going to shoot through the view screen. Yeah. You know, at the alien.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, how'd you get this job, Worf? Like, you know, shoot the...
I'm sorry, but I have to get my nitpicks out of the way. And I know this is earlier on, and I know this is, you know, 25 years or so, or 20-something years after the original series went off the air. You guys are finding your feet underneath you, trying to find identity. And so this kind of hypercriticism is through the lens of looking back now 40 years or, you know, 35 years. So it's a lot easier to say, hey, that's not, you know, and that's not, you know, women should be treated like this, because we have evolved in that time as far as a society, as far as how we think about how things should be. But
a little bit. Baby steps.
But the thing that bothered me as well is they keep playing on this Wesley at the helm or on the bridge trope. This is the third episode.
So irresponsible.
It's the third episode. It's happened twice already. It's too much in too short of amount of a span. And it also bothers me. And I'll tell you why. It is a disrespect for all of the people who spent years in Starfleet Academy earning their way, earning their stripes, working their way up from the lower decks to being on the bridge with the captain and having a seat at the bridge.
And you're putting the lives of 1,000 people at risk on a, well, right. You know, it'll probably be fine. I mean, what's all with all this probably be fine stuff?
But that's so anti-military.
1,000 lives.
Yeah.
When can, I don't care if it's the admiral or if it's the captain, when does his nephew or kid or friend's son get to like steer the ship? Or fly the stealth bomber.
Sounds like Hollywood stuff.
It's ridiculous, because it's disrespectful for the people that had to work their ass off to get to that position. It's actually a form of kind of nepotism and almost white privilege, if I have to say. Uh-huh. It's kind of a white privilege thing, because who else feels like they're entitled to just go in here and walk into like the, you know, this would be called classified. This area would be classified. It's a starship going out. So it's like, you know, this is not, you don't get to be privy to these discussions happening in this section of the hull.
I'm glad you mentioned entitlement, because there was actually a line there where when Picard is kind of telling Data about the Prime Directive, and he says, I'm sorry, this is becoming a speech. And Troy said a line that I don't think was intended as a double entendre, but it sounded like it. She says, you're the captain, sir. You're entitled. And I was like, do you realize what you just
speaking
said?
Speaking of entitled.
I was like right on the nose there.
Right on. God.
I don't like Wesley being just running amok inside of the bridge. It doesn't seem right. It's not a kid. This is not a toy. This makes light of the seriousness also, or the gravity of what's happening.
Right. We're supposed to see it on the other side. We're supposed to think, oh, Picard is being such a curmudgeon. But I don't. I'm like, no, Picard's right. Get that kid off the bridge. This is insane.
But it also sets up the character of Wesley to be just this, just unruly, inappropriate, you know, privileged little squeaky nerd. And it was a, you know, you'll see how it fulfills itself, because he just becomes, you know,
he doesn't know the boundaries or the limits.
There's no boundaries, no limits.
It's good. And as Beverly Crush, as the mother, she's the one supposed to be, you know, laying out boundaries for her kid and saying, no, this is as far as it goes.
Yeah, but
and
she's guilting Picard into it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. She's like, helping. She's making it worse. So I'm thinking, I don't like this whole character arc they have him started off on. It's not a good feel for me. I really like him. And I think he's a very adorable kid, as you know. He just looks like a good kid in this show. You know, I don't know what he was like, But he's
amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, he comes across like a really good kid, which is why I would love to see him, but being more on the mischievous kind of running around the ship, doing stuff type of character, as opposed to, like, dude, get out of here, man. Seriously.
I think it would have been nice. You know, we're always talking about him having this genius. And, you know, we saw a little bit of it in The Naked Now, of him, you know, doing this tractor beam and, you know, all these different things and kind of, you know, calling the shots to get us out of where we were going. But, you know, I think it would have been nice to kind of get to know him, who he is, in his talents and his depths.
Good point.
You know, and take the time maybe interacting with other kids on the ship. I mean, there are other kids on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
let us come to the conclusion that he's smart rather than just telling us he's smart. Yeah.
Exactly. See, not tell.
Show, don't tell. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. Let me give a little bit of backstory on this, because I was so baffled by this. I kind of did a little bit of looking. I wish I had time to go a little deeper. But what I found were just more question marks. Initially, when this was written, and it makes you think, well, was it the script that was the major problem somewhat, or the directing? But it was originally supposed to be the alien race, the Logonians, were supposed to be a reptile race, reptilian in nature, you know, maybe like the Jem'Hadar or something like that. Now, and they were supposed to have like Japanese elements, which is like, the, you know, everything is about, you know, honor and customs and all that kind of, they were kind of trying to take from these ancient Japanese kind of cultures, right? So it's supposed to be a mixture of, say, like reptilian with Japanese elements. And Star Trek does that all the time. They grab elements from certain cultures that we know in the past and present. But then at the beginning of the episode, apparently it shifted to ancient Chinese, because Picard said, you know, an old culture that we revere is very similar to yours, the Song Dynasty in China, which is pronounced S-O-N-G, but he pronounced it Song Dynasty, which was like 900 AD to 1300 something AD or something like that. So now went from Japanese to Chinese. They're clearly not wearing Japanese or Chinese garb. It looks more like Indian garb. So they're just the Ligonians. So they're just throwing, and then they didn't end up being reptiles. I'm like, what happened here? I mean, I don't know if that script was a gem, but certainly along the way, all of these things I don't know if it was budgeting, you know, because obviously, Denise, you probably know budget cuts. You know, sometimes they're planning on doing something big and they're like, nope. You know, Ira's been upset that, you know, he wanted 40 or 100 extras for past tense and they got like 8. He's like, this doesn't look like anything. But anyway, it just seemed so. The last thing on that was that the director, Russ Mayberry, and I don't know if this ever happening on any other episode to my knowledge, he ended up getting fired because Gene Roddenberry was not happy with, among other things, the casting of an all black cast to play these reptilian Japanese, Chinese, Indians. And so he replaced him with the AD, who was Sirach Les Landau. Anyway, that's just brings up more questions.
God, I don't, you know, that's so funny.
Do you remember? Okay, you don't remember who was directing, like if he directed just a little bit or a lot?
I think he directed a little bit, if anything. I know the name, you know, Russ Mayberry. But I mean, I can't even envision him. I can't picture him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know even that part. And
the co-writer, Catherine Powers, did do one other Star Trek episode, mm-hmm. and it was the second episode of Deep Space Nine as well. And that's it. And the one that co-wrote with her had no other writing credits.
Michael Barron. Okay. And in reference to what you just said, Ryan, first note I had in my note was when they mentioned the Song Dynasty and China.
Yeah,
I think it was the first time that I can remember now that China has been referenced by itself in a Star Trek episode. And so I thought that was kind of cool, actually, that it's not just about America, which we always, they always talk about, you know, the, you know, Starfleet Academy in San Francisco and a lot of American references, but they actually made a reference to China in this episode. I kind of loved that a little bit.
Right. And especially that Picard said it's a culture we all admire. So he was painting it in a positive light, you know, so it didn't come off as like, oh, you guys act like these guys back in the past. He was saying we all admire it. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a good thing because that's also part of our collective history. The other thing I liked, you know, you mentioned the clothing, and I thought it was more reminiscent of the Moorish style of clothing that the Moors wore in, you know, during the 7th to 13th century, I think.
Yeah, because I was seeing like the turbans and all that, but you're right. Now that you mention it, the way the sashes kind of come over, they kind of have like a style of the djinn, D-J-I-N. Kind of, that's, yeah, you're probably right. It's probably closer to that.
Now, that now, and again, in reference to what you were saying about what the original idea of the Langonians and them being a reptilian, that's another thing that that bothered me, because they were dealing with an alien race, but these just look like black Americans on the planet.
Have a forehead.
Give them a wrinkled nose, you know, one thing on their eye, maybe even like contacts or something. Something to make them look like aliens. These were humans dressed up in, you know, Moroccan clothing. And I'm like, what is going on here? This is not exactly. Well,
that's what's weird. Is did they substitute blackness?
Yeah, for their
alien.
Exactly, and that's another problem I had.
This has been.
I think that's the crux of it. I think that was the big thing. That
this has been the deepest. Yeah. Rooted theme problem for this episode. I'm just going to call it out.
I agree.
This is in itself that you, that's what you're saying, is that this is the alien planet.
Right.
And they're black. But they're human. They look exactly like us.
They speak English.
Black. And they're all black. Like they're all
but it's
black.
Okay because they like porcelain horses and they wear rock and
clothes. We're not all white. On our ship. Yeah.
So there it is. That I'm like, where is the thing that differentiation makes them alien?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I also noticed that Worf wasn't in this episode.
Me too.
If not at all, maybe very little, but I don't think at all.
Not at all.
And there's a reason for that, because it would, you know, here a real black alien would contrast against these fictitious black aliens that they're trying to sell us, and it would look ridiculous if you saw the two of them next to each other, because then it would look like these are just humans. And I think there was a purposeful extraction of Worf from this story because of the contrast there. It would openly and be blatant that, you know, they have put little or no, they put zero effort into making these people look like they're aliens.
They subbed it out for blackness.
Yes.
They swapped it out for blackness.
Exactly. Zero effort.
I finally had a term for it. I've been grappling with this, why this is so uneasy.
I think that's the thing. Yeah.
The core root of the problem with this episode.
And that's what I was saying. Digging into the background of it. It explains some things, but it doesn't actually help their case. Like, I was kind of baffled. I was like, maybe I can get more answers from, you know, reading deeper into it. But really, that just kind of almost makes it look worse.
Makes it worse.
Yeah.
It looks worse to me that your original concept was a reptilian type of thing.
And we can't afford lizards. All right. Can we afford black guys? What is this? That's terrible. What is that supposed to mean?
But they used reptilian kind of creatures down the road.
Yes.
I mean, I think in episodes coming up, you'll see a kind of reptilian, you know, creatures. I mean, did Michael Westmore need some time off that week, or, you know?
Did they spend too much on week one?
Oh, my gosh. I just think it was.
I think we're giving them too much credit, actually. Yeah. I think, you know, truth be told, they sat around and said, wait, they're all black. That'll be interesting.
Well, that's the word. Yeah. That's why apparently, and this is, you know, hearsay, I don't know how reliable all this stuff is, but that apparently is verbatim why Gene Roddenberry fired the director, was because he took issue with the guy's casting choices. And for the reasons that I'm sure the same reasons we're all talking about right now, which was why he fired him.
Well, I mean, Gene had to have been in on it from the beginning, though. I mean, I would imagine any casting for the guest stars or the, you know, certainly the main characters, they had to go, Gene had to approve. It wasn't just, you know, Russ Mayberry in the room with Junie Lowry.
This is why you need producers were in.
Yeah.
This is why you need Black people or somebody who's sensitive to these kinds of things. Right. In the decision-making flow right. of the process, because yep. somebody should have been sitting there saying, no, this is bad. We have to change this up and make them look like aliens. So you can put ridges, you could put dots, you can put polka dots on them. You could do whatever right. you want,
mm-hmm. right.
but let's take this out of the realm of the African-American man that we know today. Cause this is exactly what it looks like. And there's no differentiation. And
exactly. That's a really good point.
And now it's you cool. layer on, you know, I want the white woman, you know, for me, I'm sexually aroused by her.
And now we're just
feeding into this.
Right.
You know?
And if this is an alien race, okay, another planet, and they have an entire planet full of exactly looking people to the human being species and population that we have. That would be the discovery. That would be the thing to be like, wow, I can't believe that we found a group of people that look exactly like right. them. They speak English and everything.
Not for exactly. Not for the last time either. It's yeah, gonna happen absolutely. Again.
That would be the discovery. That would be absolutely. The central theme to the episode. We just found an entire civilization of people that have have evolved in the same human being species type of way that we have. They speak English and they have some technology. They're beaming people. They're beaming. Yeah. They have their own beaming devices. Yeah. So this, right. they're not, you know, they're pretty advanced group of
absolutely.
People. That would be, that in itself should be
they
the discovery.
Beautifully.
Yeah. yeah. That would be the discovery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
But instead wow. they just really try to pass them off, and it would be no worse if they used any other demographic of people as the race to pass them along as aliens. If they were right. Latinos, if they were Asian, it would still be bad because right. you have done zero modification to convince the audience that these are not human beings.
Yeah. You're just using the color of the skin.
I think that's great, Strzok. I think that it's a good point where if there was a Black person in the room, not excusing any white people for not having caught this, but let's say that they didn't. And there was a Black person in the room that said, one second, please. Yes, great audition. Thank you. We'll be right with you. I couldn't help but notice that every one of the actors that are auditioning here are all Black. Is there a reason for this? Because either, as Strzok said, you put polka dots on all of them or something,
right.
or something. You mix it up, but it can't, it's one or the other. And that, you know, that's it. Otherwise this is going to look very, very bad. And it's also sending out a message, not just the optics of it. It sends out a message that we don't want to send.
Yeah. And then I would have also added to that fact that
you idiot
character can't, you know, the way he was drooling over this white woman, it was like too much for me. I was like, this is too much. This is a trope. This is a stereotype. And they're taking it to the maximum degree here with the kidnapping and the whole life or death fight till death. But I want to say, you know, because we've done enough trashing of this episode, I do want to talk about some of the good points and good moments.
Oh, well, we've got to go to the free for all. Sorry, everybody.
Let me get one in. Denise, this is for Denise. this is for you, Denise, because I thought you did a great job. This one line that you said when you said, you know, they were talking about the whole, you know, this is when he finally got exposed and his whole plot and his wife. But you looked at him, you said, how sad for you.
Yeah.
And the way you said it, And you followed that line up with such a waste. I thought those were the best delivered lines of the episode. And totally. I thought you knocked it out of the park.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that your home run of the day? Ta-da.
That's my home run. Yeah.
There should be no home run. That's
it. Oh. Yeah. That's my one and only home run.
I'll tell you
how sad for you, because I really felt sad for everybody involved in this, but you pretty much epitomized it.
I encapsulated the entire my through line for the episode.
Yeah,
that one delivery. I was really saying how sad for me.
Do you have a home run for the day, as best you can find one?
I'm gonna give it to myself on this one that I got through this damn thing alive, and you know, had a career afterwards, you know, that's an out of the park home run right there.
Well, let's make it three for three.
I would love to see a scene where you slap Captain Picard and say, "If you ever let that happen again."
For the record, I don't want to make you look bad in front of your new friends, but. No, but I want to make it three for three, because actually piggybacking on what Sirach said at the end of the episode, it hit me that we're only three episodes in. But the thought came to me where I was like, you know, there is a real evident element that Tasha Yar brings to this show. And it hit me that it's such a travesty. We don't have to talk about it in this episode. We'll have plenty of time. That you were not in the seven seasons, because there's a very clear nook, an element, a nook of the crew that you fulfill that nobody else does in this show, you know, where we are or in the future. And it just made me really sad that, like, we did not get to see that element throughout the show and fulfilled throughout the show and grow, and how it would have affected certain scenes and certain episodes and certain relationships. There was just a very clear thing that you fulfill in this show that it's very evident.
That is so beautifully said. Thank you so much. You know, it is interesting, again, you know, what I'm experiencing watching this. Yeah. There is that quality that Tasha Yar has that's different from everyone else in just her, she's grounded in, you know, you feel she's real.
Authentic.
Exactly.
There's a lot of depth to that character.
Struggling with anything that comes up. She's trying to factor it in, figure it out. She's not the computer, that she's not data that's just espousing.
She's not the know-it-all.
Right. She's grounded. She's earthy. She's real. She's emotional. She's sensual. She's, you know, there's things. And that is what I believe, you know, because people have scratched their head and said, it's amazing you were only on the show one season. It feels like you were so present in this show. But I think she hits, you know, that character hits people in the heart, you know, and we'll see as we go along. I mean, these first three are super packed with, you know, her.
Well, that's the thing, all of this in just three episodes, right? So just three episodes in, we're getting all of this.
And I care so much about your character. I was like, what are you guys doing? This is not fair to her. Like, your character to me has really started off the best on this show.
Yeah.
It's the most grounded. It is the most believable aspect of the show so far. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've been kicking it out and knocking it out of the park. So
you're our slugger. You're our number four hitter.
Yeah.
Aaron Judge, look out, baby.
Yeah, here we go. She's our slugger. Yeah. Cleanup hitter. All right. Look, let's hit the free for all. Right before we do, let's give a very special thanks to Homer Frizzell, Dr. Anne Marie Siegel, Eve England out in Wales, Yvette Blackman, Tom Carmen, aka Skillet, TJ Jackson Bay, number one Grizzlies fan, Bill Victor Arukin, Titus Moeller, Darlena Marie, Dr. Muhammad Noor, Tierney C. Diekman, Anna Post, Rex A. Wood, Anil O. Palat, Joe Balsarati, Mike Gu, DQ, Neil Akasaka, Justine Norton Kurtzen, Dr. Stephanie Baker, Carrie Schwent, Faith Howell, Edward Foltz, my live from Tokyo, Matt Boardman, Chris McGee, Justin Weir, Jake Barrett, Jane Jorgensen, and of course, Dr. Susan V. Gruner. I doubt she's going to attend this one. We'll see on the other side. Stick around. We'll be right back on The Seventh Rule. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Seventh Rule. This is the free-for-all. We're going to have a blast. I don't think there were any non-appearance mentions today. I did not catch any unless somebody else did. Something that I forgot was because we are masochists, Jake Sisko guesses the IMDb score.
This is probably like a solid 4.5.
That's generous.
Anybody else have any guesses that doesn't happen to know the answer?
2.3.
Yeah, that sounds 3.7.
Harsh critics generous. Today. Holy cow.
3.5.
The a answer. $1.
TJ's taking $1.
$1. It's like
$1.
$1. He's got the sticks.
TJ, you're not the only one.
Oh my God, you guys, are you serious?
TJ, that's awesome.
Oh, I got to get some sticks too. I got my drums.
I want
the sticks.
Okay, well, the answer was 8. Point no, it's a 5.1. Is this possibly the lowest rated? I don't know. I didn't check that, but it's certainly one of. Well, Melissa, start us off. Have you seen this episode recently? What'd you think?
I did see it recently. And I knew what the reaction was going to be coming in. So I tried to watch it with more generous eyes this time around. Well, honestly, I'd forgotten this episode. I don't remember watching it before.
Lucky.
But it reminded me a lot of a TOS episode. And I know that it wasn't written by Gene Roddenberry, but I heard his voice in this episode over everyone else's, over the writers, over the directors, over the characters. It felt like, you know, it reminded me of this old movie, 1902 movie, A Trip to the Moon, where a handful of men climb into this hollowed out bullet and shoot themselves out of a cannon to the face of the moon. And it's really their story of what they imagined the moon might be like.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, they don't have the science to fill in the holes of this imagination. So they don't, and to me, it felt like somebody was trying to write a story of their curiosity of different cultures. But they did it in a way where it was kind of narrow and not as progressive as maybe 1987 would be. But it felt like, you know, he was maybe going back to the safety of, you know, the 60s and what he knew and all of that. So it wasn't as, you know, a broad a scope of the story that he may have wanted to tell. So I think it fell short in that way. And maybe he was unintentionally, you know, creating his own trip to the moon in a sense, if that makes sense.
You know, a lot of people said it was a very original series episode. It felt very much like original series, the costumes, the sets, all that. Mm-hmm. Also, Fred Steiner was a original series composer, and he composed this episode. And that's why actually we didn't mention it, but that was maybe the best part of the episode, was the amazing composing and the scoring and all that. It sounded great. It sounded like original series. Poor Fred.
Well, and the scene between Geordi and Data was cute. The shaving scene.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't cover that.
Cute. I liked that.
You mean you didn't include
Oh no. TJ Jackson Bay, let's include a little you. Who is that? Flanders? What do you think of this episode?
Oh, have you tried watching it as a comedy?
You have to.
I laughed a lot. I'll say that.
Okay. Captain Picard actually uses the word token in this episode when he presents the gift to Lieutenant.
So, oh, really?
Cringe. He also offered to show Lutan the holodeck, but he wanted Riker and Troy to do that. And he emphasized that there were many uses for the holodeck.
Yeah,
I kind of wonder what Riker and Troy would have shown him, since we know them a lot better now. And Ryan, I'm sorry, but French is an obscure, ancient Earth language.
Oh, we didn't talk about that. That's right. He got so offended. I thought that was hilarious how he got all like, well, it's sophisticated and how would you know? You're British.
Right. Also, if Picard gets hurt, Riker's going to write him up.
Mm-hmm.
Data's tongue slips. That's kind of curious that happens, but it does apparently.
Yark,
I do appreciate from this episode. I've never, been one for how they bend over backwards to honor someone else's culture and not, include any elements of their own. But I do appreciate. Kind of their way of navigating the prime directive is that we don't just come in and take what we want because we have the power. Like, mm-hmm. We're going to try to work, within the system and, really, get to know another culture. As flawed as that's portrayed, that's still, a good ideal to have, I think. Also, hashtag laser cage match. How about that? Cage match with an electrical fence. That was pretty cool. And Hagan, after he got chosen as first one, and he's standing there behind Garena, just kind of caressing her hair. He could not wait to get off the Enterprise.
Right. Yeah.
And lastly, okay, so they got the vaccine, mission accomplished. Millions of people are going to be saved. I'm pretty sure we're in a hurry to get there. So let's go at warp 3.
Yeah. Rude.
You don't want any speeding tickets.
Yeah. Well, no stranger to speeding tickets. Eve England is out in Wales, but do they give speeding tickets on the left side of the road?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't, I don't know, the metric system. So how do you feel about
her eyebrows?
Yeah. That's about as rude as she get.
Well, I didn't know anything about this episode before I started watching it, which obviously caused me some challenges watching it. I almost turned it off, actually. And I was like, no, okay, I've got to see it through. I've got to, it might get better. And then I did watch it. And I just, for all the reasons that I'm sure you've already talked about, it just was just cringe the whole time. And I couldn't see past some of those problematic elements of it. And it wasn't until after I went back and obviously then started to read some reviews and I was like, oh, okay, so this is how everybody sees it. Because I was thinking, my gosh, what is this? We're in episode 3. And I said, I don't know if I can continue to watch this TV show if it's kind of going to be like this the whole time. But it sounded like this is a blip. And obviously there were consequences to the directors, et cetera, at the time. So I felt a bit reassured after that. And sort of looked back at it in that context and how everybody was discussing it at the time and how people see it now. So I thought that was really interesting. But the there wasn't much in the companion actually this time. But what was interesting was obviously the holodeck black and yellow screen that TJ's got. It's the first time we see that. And obviously, you know, that becomes iconic. But they also said that that little device you were using, Denise, in that scene, which is like the sort of telepad, they obviously realized that was a bit redundant and we never saw that again. Mm. So I thought that was an interesting fact.
Mm. Yeah. Good point. Mm-hmm. So you try to watch it to the end. You're like, maybe it's going to get better, but...
Yeah, because when you read back and, you know, when it was supposed to be with lizard people, I just think it would have been such a different show. And it's just not good. But looking forward to next week.
Well, yeah. Tell me about it. Well, Sue, you didn't tend this one, right? what'd you think?
Oh, I remember. Oh my God, I remember it. I just watched it. And all I can say is that it reeks of Gene Roddenberry's mindset for the 80s. And that's the way you have to look at it. And this time when I watched it, all I could think of was, she's in the same uniform for days at a time. Well, how come they didn't give her new clothes or something while she was captive in their culture or something? And that was really the only, besides it being very strange. And just reminded me actually of, as we have been saying, of the original series. It was, I think initially he tried to copy some things too much. And clearly, he hadn't found his footing with the next gen yet. But yeah.
Looking forward to next week, too.
Why? Denise, did they even try to put you in something different other than your uniform?
No. It was probably the last thing on my mind, actually, while shooting that. I believe it or not, was questioning that how this was ever going to air. How are they ever going to get this past, you know, the censors, past, you know, network? And I said, people must not be paying attention. I mean, how can you possibly make this episode and have this get on the air? And you know, it was problematic even then. It really is. You can really get some perspective being 35 years away from it and tease it out. But you know, so the it never came up. It's not really clear how long I've been in captivity. It feels to me probably only a day at most. So it doesn't really, you know, it's kind of, I've got the you know, Ralph Macchio headband on and, you know, and for the fight and, you know, that's a little altercation.
I actually made a note of that, Denise. I called you the Yarati kid.
Yeah, I know that. I just, you know, and I'll give you a little. My idol. Yeah, it's the '80s. You know, we're all wearing headbands. I was thinking, watching that that sort of jungle gym thing we're fighting on. It was, you know, set aside all the writing and structure errors in this episode, that jungle gym is consisted of the neon glass tubing. That's actual neon glass. Wow. That they have. Now, who in their right mind makes a fighting apparatus
out of glass?
So this young lady who I'm fighting, at one point trips, and a knee-jerk reaction reaches out to grab and breaks the neon tubing. And it shatters and neon gas is flowing.
Jeez.
And I get a splinter in my eye. So all shooting has to stop. And I have to go to the, you know, doctors, an eye specialist who has to flush my eye out. And, you know, thank God nothing, you know, happened. But it's just, you know, one of many bizarro things about this episode, you know, that stick with me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yikes.
Oh. Mm. That's it. That story's not in the companion.
No, that's not in there. Take that with you guys. Run with it.
Well, I have one of those uniforms, not yours, but, and I don't know how you wore those things. The mannequin that I have is a size 2. And it barely fits on the mannequin. It's small. It's so little. I mean, they were so tight. How could you move?
Well, they, you know, I didn't have as much problems with the uniform as some of the men did. They stretch, you know, it was like a Lycra, you know, stretch. Mm-hmm. So I could move around freely in it. And I had been a dancer and practiced yoga. As a matter of fact, after, you know, you see me do Aikido in this, in this show, from that point going forward, twice a week, Frakes and I had an Aikido instructor come to the set. And during lunch, we would study Aikido with them. They had the idea that if there were more sequences like that down the line, you know, fight sequences or battle sequences or, you know, holodeck fights or whatever, that our body language would have to be precise, you know, would have to look like we really knew what we were doing. So I thought that was a great idea. And that sort of came out of that episode.
Are you muted, Ryan?
I think Ryan's muted.
Yeah, I hear.
That's too bad. I made a really good Aikido joke. But the point is, what's up, Mai? How are you live in Tokyo?
Good, sleepy. Very early. Good morning. This is my new uniform. It's going to happen a lot of weeks. Get ready for it. This is a tough audience for this episode. I think that the way I looked at it was how they wrote something then that's really applicable now, given our values and how they've evolved over time. And I don't know that it wasn't on purpose, to be honest. I thought that, you know, treating arrogance and sexism as a cultural imperative to be respected is super hard to swallow. Mm. But I think it was an intentional message from the writers that the opposite is better and correct. At least that's the way I saw that. In the opening scene, the use of the term "the female," as if she were being identified by her gender identity to the exclusion of all else. My perspective is clearly that gender identity is part of the whole, but not the entire definition of a person. And so that was, I think, a very clear statement that they were trying to make to say the opposite. At the end, when Hagon says, "Well, you see, Captain, you may excel in technology, but not in civilized behavior," I think, again, it was a statement by the writers about the absolute absurdity of a woman having to give away her own dowry to receive the love of a man or respect in society. Mm-hmm. I thought that they were sending a message there. You know, here in this story, a woman's dowry was her worth, and there was no perception of anything else beyond that as to who the person was. But the funny thing with that was that made me chuckle was that in their society, which has these ridiculous values, it was the man who was almost branded with the necklace showing that he was in possession of her land. So that was kind of cool. Question for Denise on this. At the cheeky little grin after you say there would be complications at the end, when turning down the offer of Lutan by his ex-wife, was this a direction, part of the script? It felt like an embellishment that was really in line with what we've been seeing of this subtle and continued efforts to show that this tough security person has a personal side, a softer side, an aspect of humanity, if you will. What was that about?
That's a really wonderful observation. I, you know, we talked about this a little bit, that there, an interesting, you know, they missed an opportunity here in this story to really let this unfold between these two people, that there was a genuine attraction, just the, you know, the first hit that, you know, one gets with someone. Now, what an interesting story it would have been to observe, you know, these two cultures, these two different cultures coming together and perhaps, you know, really, really sharing something and growing this relationship. And, you know, this vaccine is in the background and, you know, is he going to, Lutan going to choose to take her? Is he going to let her go back? Is she going to decide to abandon ship and go there? And, you know, what are these, and to get to know each other and let this kind of play out. Instead, it's so brutal and aggressive and without any understanding of, you know, just brute sexuality, you know, is just thrown in there. And, you know, it's so interesting that what the Ligonians revere, the men, how they respect their women is for their belongings, their land, their possessions. And yet here he's willing to abandon all of that, that his cultural references and his identity to a woman because of her strength. That she has nothing, you know, in terms of what they consider of value. But that none of that gets explained to us, you know. It's just this hammered on, you know, sexualized, I'm sexualized in it by him. And, you know, it just is so complicated. So to answer your question, it was like I was taking all of what I was, well, I mean, the right answer, really, I thought, watching it again, would have been, I'm kind of surprised at her in the way Tasha handles this. You know, the wife now says, do you want him? And she says, well, no, it would be complicated. Instead of going, are you kidding me? Why would I want him? He kidnapped me. He forced me to fight you to the death. I plus my crew, I don't even know where, you know, why didn't they get me out of here right away? You know, I mean, it was so strange that she would kind of consider it even for a second. Now, perhaps the writers do want to show her being, you know, she's still a woman. She's still sexual. She still has desires, and but it really rings untrue to me at this point watching it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Thank you.
There was also that weird ending where she says, "You can be my second now. Take your place behind me." That was such a shift in tone that made no sense. Where suddenly now she's the boss and she's like, get your ass back there. You don't, you know, take your place. Yeah. Anyway. So I think Faith Howell has joined us. Hello, Faith. Welcome. We are just saying but scintillating things about this episode. up next is Justin Weir. What's up, Justin? How are you?
What's up, guys? Happy to be here. I love hearing all your thoughts. You guys say things that my mind doesn't even go to. All right. Well, not my favorite episode, but I am very familiar with TNG, and I know this episode well. I took some notes. I think, Denise Crosby, you carried this episode. I think I have a couple of good lines that you delivered, and I thought they were awesome. When you said, of course it felt good. Troy, you're my friend and you tricked me. Like, love it.
Bitch.
And then when
friends like
at the end when you said at the end of the episode when you said, how sad for you, it was like a mic drop. Like,
yeah.
That was like nothing more after that. Where's Worf? Where's Worf?
Oh yeah. Well,
and I find it weird that we have this new alien culture and honor is everything. That's Klingons, right?
Totally.
So
Yeah.
A little confusing.
Mm-hmm.
I felt bad for the poor bystander when the girls were fighting and he just gets, he dies to the side.
He didn't even realize it right away. I'm like,
no,
hey, you got
he did it.
Like, you had to take it by a spiky ball. Like, you would notice that.
You gotta be careful when you're in red.
The show was so exciting. I also love Beverly's line when she's dying. Sorry, that clashes with my instructions or whatever she said.
Mm-hmm.
Before she revived her.
Orders.
Yeah. Eve England, shout out, because I did not know this was the first episode that showed the holodeck in its natural state. That's some good knowledge.
Well, thanks to that's the companion, so I can't take credit for that. But yeah, good of luck. Yeah.
But good job reading.
And I will say the Wesley Crusher stuff was pretty cool. As Beverly brought up Wesley to Picard, he's like, wait, what? Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, he was so pissed.
He was. He doesn't, but he's slowly coming more of the crew.
All right.
Yeah, that's all I got. Oh, wait.
Good stuff. Very nice. Drumsticks. Carrie Schwent is also here hanging out. Cool backdrop. How are you, Carrie?
Thank you. Yeah, I found a sunset that I had taken a while back that was absolutely perfect for the pink sunsets in the episode. But I've got my limerick, I've got my favorite scene, and then some compliments for Denise. So I'll dive right in. There's a planet that possesses a cure, but they must see respect to be sure. Lutan says, Tasha's fine. Irina says, hey, he's mine. The vaccine in the end is secured. Yes. Now, my favorite scene, kind of like Justin, I love anything involving Wesley Crusher. He is my number one favorite, number two being Q, because I have a crush on him even after all these years. But the scenes with Wesley were just great. And the best one is when Picard walks onto the bridge and you can see in everybody's face, they're wondering how long it's going to take him to notice that Wesley is there. And then he does, he's like, oh, Wesley. Oh, okay, cool. Thanks. And, yeah. And Will Wheaton just kept it just nice and subtle. He's like just chilling. And I often wonder how they can see the display, because it looks like they're reclining at like a 45 degree angle. It looks comfortable, but yet it doesn't look comfortable enough to do their job. But that's been the question that's always been in the back of my mind. But
remember the guy
I'm picking up a signal.
No, the ensign that was on the encounter at Farpoint that sat in for a moment. And he was like,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
I see guys right around like that in LA.
So funny.
But my compliment for Denise, the way you were in such a problematic episode, the way you were able to show so many sides of Tasha throughout the entire episode, her pride in the Federation and her training and her ship and the attraction that, there's those waves of attraction coming from this guy. I imagine she gets that somewhat often, but when it's so, in your face, you're going to have a nice little self-confidence boost from that. So you've got that layer and you're just the tiniest bit tempted, but you're practical enough to know that, the reality of it just would never work. And just all the layers of her in the tiny little exchange with Deanna when she just sort of reads your mind without permission.
Great. Thank stuff. You. Very nice. Jed Thompson is here. Finally, here he is wearing a cool Chat Pack shirt. How are you? Have you seen this episode recently? And great timing in joining us, by the way.
Yeah, I'm going to take a moment here and say I enjoyed the DS9, the latter part of that, and decided that this was a great opportunity to jump in with where I jumped in with Trek. You know, it was a couple years after. I didn't see this. Yeah, sorry, Denise. I didn't see this first run, I came back to it. And my husband and I, we actually watched all of Trek during the pandemic because there's 870 episodes, and we'll get into that at some point as well. But we went backwards, and so we watched TNG relatively recently, and so I did, but I also went back and rewatched this, and I have obviously there's some issues with this episode, the melodrama is strong with this one, and it did feel very TOS. I think Melissa, you said something like it's very original series, not Trek's finest moment. You know, I think we all agree about that. One thing that I really appreciated right off the bat was a woman chief of security, and then Tasha throws down. You know, so I like that. You know, 1987. You know, and it was just no, that's not going to happen. There's some good points in this, so that was one of them. I thought, and I also thought that when Tasha's in training, in the holodeck, the safety protocols are definitely off most of the time. It'd be my gut feeling. That's, you know, the one other one other thing, the immediate Picard reaction when Tasha gets kidnapped is to fire spread of photon torpedoes, and it's for display. And it felt so anti-Trek, anti-Federation, you know, open a dialogue first, you know, shoot later. And in this case, it was definitely flipped around.
We're going to smoke them out.
Yeah. So that I just obviously still, you know, episode 4, episode 3 here, you know, and it's, there's a few, 100 and some odd more to go to even things out here, but it was,
yeah, a little bit of a rough start, but you didn't though, Jed. Thank you. That was great stuff. Chris McGee, what is up? How are you? What'd you feel about this episode? Did you like it? What'd you think?
Honestly, despite all of its problems, I still enjoyed watching it just as much as I did back when I was a preteen when it first aired, because I didn't see the problems with the episode. I just enjoy the story. It's at its heart, it's a Prime Directive story and so forth. So I just kind of enjoyed that. I was kind of blind to anything else that was happening there that shouldn't have happened. But I will say though that I know Soraki said that there is no honor in this episode. I beg to differ. There's quite a bit. After all, the word was mentioned 15 times in the entire episode. I did like how Picard, you know, offered that artifact to Lutan. And I think that, I don't know, maybe Picard has a passing interest in archaeology or something. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Personally, I would love to hear the rest of Picard's speech to Data when he was telling him about the Prime Directive there. But and you missed, Ryan, there is a name, a non-appearance mention, Emperor Soong of the Soong Dynasty. That qualifies, right?
If we see him at some point. I don't think we do, though, right? Maybe, I don't remember.
Half a name. So, and lastly, my phrase of the
episode. That would be a ham, by the way.
Ham.
Here's the episode. Everyone knows it. Everyone loves it, I'm sure. So why don't we say it together here? Ready? 3, 2, 1. Then you shall have no treaty, no vaccine, and no Lieutenant Yar.
Lieutenant Yar.
Nice. That's our new motto. Justin likes it. He's muted, but everybody listening in, he's hitting his sticks together. Good stuff, Chris. Tierney C. Diekman is here. Boy, oh boy, what, this is looking good stuff. She's got a Star Trek shirt on. She got a cool, what are those, beanie? Like Mr. Aaron Eisenberg used to always wear. How are you?
I am all right. Wow, this episode. Oh my God. Can one be both abhorred and bored at the same time? It's so slow. I might just be me, but it felt so slow moving watching this and analyzing it. I mean, just a few strange knowledge points. So I don't know if she was the writer or just one of the writers, but Catherine Powers, she a few years later wrote also the third episode after a two-part pilot for Stargate SG-1 called Emancipation, which is so incredibly similar, so incredibly racist, really? And sexist, that the first time I watched that episode thought, what is this, Code of Honor? And looked into it and was like, are you kidding me? Is this writer okay? Like with her soul, is she okay? And the Lieutenant character on that, played by Kerry Hiroyuki Tagawa, some people might know him as Shang Tsung from Mortal Kombat. He was also in Encounter at Farpoint.
Yes,
he was. Also sort of racist role of the Mandarin bailiff. He's Japanese, but either way, just strange little crossovers there. But wow, I forgot how not just racist, but horribly sexist this episode is. Like you, Eve, I really wanted to turn it off. And I've seen this episode several times, but I've never tried to actually analyze it without just like laughing the whole time at how bad it was and kind of paying attention to other things. So I'll just go to some positives here, because that's what I just tried to do, was look for positives. And a big one being kind of like last episode, Denise, you carried this. And I'm not trying to be biased. I really looked at it like this, like your performance did for a lot of these scenes that are so hard to take. And I love seeing tough Tasha, seeing a female security officer, never seemed out of place to me in any way. And you pulled it off in everything. I mean, you could throw down, like, no problem. But I did not like, as you pointed out towards the end with that interaction with Urena, it's too, I won't go into it, but just, yeah, you made the point that I wrote down of how that interaction went down, of they downplayed what the realistic reaction should have been. That felt like how a man would have written that reaction in the 1980s and earlier, what they think that should have been like as someone who objectified women. And it bothered the heck out of me. That's not a positive though, going back. The costuming is pretty awesome, though a little primitive stereotype. It's pretty great. And everybody's got some killer workout routines going on. They can pull off those costumes real well. So that was great. There's that, like, the original series Hidden Temple kind of sets going on, which are very fun. Although, wow, neon gas glass, terrible. The score is fantastic. So yeah, it's a very transition episode. I think of this one when I think of first season, how they transition from TOS to TNG aesthetic. Oh God, what are my other positives? Did I already run out? I might have.
Well, hopefully you have a bunch more and we can save those.
Yeah, we'll skip them to the other one. But it was a tough rewatch. Not quite as tough as I thought it would be, but you're right. So much more could have unfolded with this. I wish we could have seen that. And they did you dirty yet again for your character. But also thank God for you and the early episodes of TNG, because they would have been canceled without you, I swear. Cheers to the Urati King.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Wow.
Great stuff. All right. Yeah, thanks for saving this show for us, Denise. Otherwise, what would we be talking about 35 years later? What's up, Matt Boardman?
Hey,
how are you? What do you think about this episode? You're hanging out in the holodeck as well, you and TJ.
Yeah. Different holodecks, though.
Oh.
I don't know what TJ's got going on over there. I don't want to be fine.
That's funny.
The sticks. No, it's funny because you know, as I'm sitting here listening to everybody's comments, I'm like, you know, how, I don't want to say cool, but how great is it that we can sit here 35 years later, and as a human race, we've evolved enough in our cultural understandings that we can look at this episode and we can identify the things that don't sit well with us, you know. So I think that's great that we can look at it with that lens and go, yeah, you know, these are things that were not good, but now we know better. But you know, I like to, you know, I was looking at it, I was like, okay, what can I take from this episode? Because you know, obviously there is faults, but I love that this is kind of our first look at diplomacy in The Next Generation. You know, Encounter at Farpoint kind of gave us a little bit, but this is like, okay, now here's Picard the diplomat. You know, is it perfect in the way that we get to see it? No, but we see like a genuine Picard is trying to find common ground with this alien race that's so opposite of what the Federation's values are, you know, and his attempts to kind of accommodate because they have this vaccine that they need. Which kind of made me think of what Denise was saying, you know, why would Tasha respond the way that she did? Why wouldn't she be like, you know, kind of slap him upside the head a little bit? And I think that's the Starfleet officer training in her, just kind of going, okay, I have to maintain my decorum, you know, rather than stepping out of line here. I mean, it kind of harkens back to when Worf was going to shoot the view screen when Q was on there, and he was like, what are you going to do? You're going to shoot the view screen? He's not there. You know, it was very, very out of line for what a Starfleet officer would do. But that, to me, kind of harkens to Tasha's professionalism, is that rather than, I mean, there was probably so much that was running through her head and words that were not repeatable on screen, but she bit her tongue and she just said, you know, I'm going to do the Starfleet officer thing. It just wouldn't work out, you know. So the other thing that I loved about this episode, we get some great Geordi and Data interaction there. And it's, you know, we kind of see that Data is still developing in his character and his interactions with the crew. It's great seeing Geordi shave. I don't know why. Obviously, I didn't shave today. So I was like, hey, I feel that right there.
You can live vicariously through him.
Exactly. I was like, oh, man, what is it like to shave with a sonic shaver? That would be great. But then the other thing I thought was great was, you know, we get some more Wesley. And I love with each episode, you know, you get the B and the C plots. And you know, as you start watching down the season, you see how those little things start to build on each other, you know, and this is kind of one more thing with Wesley's journey that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Wesley has been quite the topic of conversation today, before the free-for-all as well. But stay tuned to find out what that was. Faith Howell is also hanging out almost in Wesley Crusher's spot, actually, on the bridge of the Enterprise D. How are you, Faith? What'd you think of this?
Definitely episode. It's one of the weirder episodes that I remember. But I will say that Tasha was a jewel this week. so much fun to watch and think back to probably the first couple of times I watched it when I was little, and you know, going through my formative years and how lilting the delivery of the lines were and how feminine she is while she's kicking butt. So it was very interesting that they're already setting her up to be both in a lot of different ways. And so like growing up, that was an icon, and I'm sorry we didn't get more of her, but But definitely I'm going to appreciate getting to come back and watch these again. So.
Ugh, great. I know.
Sweet.
If we had 173 episodes of Tasha Yar and 4 movies, man, oh man, that would be good stuff, wouldn't it?
Well, let's do it.
Denise, Sirach, any final thoughts before we roll out on this jewel of an episode?
I don't know. Did anyone else think of Coming to America with King Joffrey Joffer?
Yes. When they rolled out the carpet.
When he rolled
out
the carpet.
That was it. Yes. When he kicks it.
I was just waiting for the rose petals, you know?
Well, and also there was that famous actor, you know, when I was a kid, who would do the 7-Up commercials.
Yes.
You know, the cola nut.
And you go, Have some 7-Up.
It was just, was it 7-Up? Yeah, I think it was. And
I'm not sure.
This kind of accent that everyone, you know, on the planet had, this kind of imperial, sort of regal, Tasha, I like, you know, it was like, what?
I am King Joffrey Joffa.
Right, exactly. It's all of this going on. And, you know, it's funny you say Coming to America, because Coming to America was filming at the Paramount lot when we were doing. Not this episode, but soon. But
they
soon.
Stole that from you guys. This was 87.
Of all the things to steal from.
Absolutely. John Landis. John Landis watched this episode and just said, I want this.
This is gold. All right. All right. Well, great stuff. So now we know that Coming to America was just trying to copy this gem of an episode.
Yeah.
But we have to launch. Thank you so much, Melissa, TJ, Eve, Sue, Mai, Chris, Jed, Carrie, Justin, Tierney, Matt, and Faith, eventually, for joining us. Thank you very much. It's been a great time. We will see you all next time on The Seventh Rule.